You've fallen down the rock and roll rabbit hole. All right, welcome back to Rock and Roll Rabbit Hole. It's Kevin Gibson and Butch Bays back again to talk some rock and roll.
Have we not been saying our names recently? Oh, we have, haven't we?
I don't know. People know us by now, hopefully.
Well, yeah, you know, hopefully someone's new on this very episode.
We're here in Louisville, Kentucky, just podcasting our little hearts out from my bar.
Absolutely.
And my dog's asleep on the couch. It's pretty laid back here at Rock and Roll headquarters.
It is laid back.
The headquarters are really, yeah. We're not getting paid enough to make it fancy.
Probably not. But I've really been looking forward to tonight. Tonight's subject matter, very near and dear to my heart. This is part of my rock and roll story, without a doubt. And I'm sure part of yours, voluntarily or involuntarily.
A little both.
Tonight we're going to talk about Jack and Diane by the great Johnny Cougar Mellencamp. Does he have more names?
I think John Cougar Mellencamp, and then John Mellencamp.
Oh, there you go.
So he changed his name almost as much as Prince.
Yeah, he should have just kept them all and kept compiling.
I guess he put a symbol at the end.
Well, you know, Prince is the other guy that has rivaled him in the name change.
The name changes, yeah.
Yeah. Never went to the symbol, I guess, right?
So not that I never remember him.
All right. So tonight I have procured for us Dragonfly IPA from Upland Brewing in John Mellencamp's current hometown.
Bloomington, Indiana. So let's pop these open.
Right, the opening ceremony.
So I have a story about Dragonfly IPA.
All right, good.
And by the way, we are not being sponsored in any way by Upland Brewing.
None whatsoever.
We just enjoy their product. So many years ago, about 12 or 13 years ago, I was in Bloomington with an ex-girlfriend. And we were at a place called the Irish Lion, I think it's called. Is that what it's called?
The Red Lion, maybe? Something. Or something?
The Lion. But it's an Irish pub. But they have raw oysters. And she and I both loved raw oysters. So we each got a dozen.
Nice.
And I put one in my mouth, and it was obviously bad. The second that it touched my palate, it started to burn.
Oh,
and so
burning.
I spat it out as quickly as I could, but the flavor lingered and lingered and lingered. So we got to the venue where we were going to see the show, concert we were there to see, Del McCoury.
Yep, and Bluegrasser, sure.
Yeah. And she said, I've got something that'll take that flavor out of your mouth. It's Dragonfly IPA from Upland. I'd never had this beer at this point.
Right.
That we're having right now. And so she brought it to me, and I started drinking it. And about four or five drinks in, she said, so how's it going? I said, it's a little better, but now it tastes like Dragonfloyster.
Dragonfloyster.
I guess we were just tipsy enough that seemed funny.
And it seems pretty funny now. Yeah.
We were standing by the edge of the stage, and we're doubled over in laughter over this.
Really?
It's one of those moments, yeah. I don't even know why we thought it was that funny at the time, but whenever I have this beer, I think of Dragonfloyster.
So it was sort of used as a cleaning agent in this story.
And it just tasted like if you put a bad oyster in an IPA.
Maybe a disinfectant. So did you keep it all down? I mean, not to get too graphic.
I never got sick.
Oh, nice.
Because I didn't eat any of it. I spat it out.
Wow.
And I did finish my oysters.
Nice.
What's funny is I complained to the waiter. I didn't complain. I told him,
"Yeah,
you guys better watch this." And I thought he'd bring me another one to replace it, and he didn't. He said, "Oh, that happens sometimes."
Well,
like,
he's
come
a
on,
tough
man. I'm
cob,
paying for this.
He?
Yeah.
All right, let's cheers. Let's, to the Rock and Roll Rabbit Hole and Rock and Roll John Mellencamp. All right, we've come to the feature here, the first feature of the show, the Tale of the Tape. Jack and Diane is a song written and performed by American singer-songwriter John Mellencamp. Back then still known as John Cougar. This is described by critics as a love ballad. The song was released as the second single from Mellencamp's 1982 album, American Fool. Boy, do I love our coming-of-age rock and roll. My favorite. So, and it was chosen by the Recording Industry Association of America as one of the songs of the century. It spent 4 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1982, and it's Mellencamp's most successful and most downloaded hit single.
Yep.
So it went number seven in Australia, better known as the land down under. Number one in Canada.
Well done, Canada.
Better known as America's Hat.
Yeah, America's Hat.
The Netherlands took it only to number 32, better known as the home country of the Van Halen brothers.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The United Kingdom, number 25. What are they known for over there?
Fish and chips.
Fish and chips. And the, yes.
The chip.
And it went numero uno on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. Yeah. So that's a great feeling for a guy from the Midwest and only about an hour from where we are currently recording this episode.
Actually, 54 miles, 54.6 miles. I mapped it.
Oh, I love it that you have the decimal.
6 miles.
That's great. So American Fool was the number one album of 1982, which on my notes it says 1882.
Wow. We're going to party like it's 1882.
Yes, we are. And it's, I wonder how you do that. You get gout or something? Or
die of dysentery at the end of the night?
That's it. Oh, this is already melting
this
down.
This is already off the rails.
It's already off the rails. Anyway, it sold three.
Stick with us. Stick with us. This yes, is serious. This
we're going to tighten this up. American Fool sold 3 million albums that year alone, which I purchased one proudly myself. So
I think I owned one too, so I probably still have it. I don't remember exactly, but I was never as big a fan as you were. But it,
right,
because of where I lived and the timing, of course, I was affected by it very, very deeply.
You couldn't avoid John Cougar where we are here.
No, you know? I mean, and you know. Like one of our favorite bands, the Bottle Rockets, have the song Indianapolis, and he mentions, you know, I'll puke if that jukebox plays John Cougar one more time. Because that's an Indiana thing.
It's in the water. It's in
yes.
the walls.
It's for better or worse, you know.
Right. Like I ventured to guess today, and I'm glad you mentioned the Bottle Rockets song that mentions John Mellencamp, because that's something I did, or they say John Cougar as John well, Cougar, which I love that. But I had forgotten about that, but it's. I imagine that we have heard Jack and Diane probably twice as much as most people around the country areas. Right?
I totally agree with that.
I've not complained about it, but maybe we probably have had our fill of the song as far as how many times we need to hear it.
Because mm-hmm. we both grew up in Southern Indiana, and
absolutely.
You still live there. I live in Louisville now, which is not that far away. But you know, it was really part of our childhood.
It was,
and I mean, it's. It was ubiquitous, and it was also the time. And one of the things I wanted to mention before we go too far forward is that we were both 16 when it was a hit.
And so it mentions
that line, hold on to 16 as long as you can. It was something that haunted me at the time.
Oh, really?
It made me think about the future, and I didn't want to think about the future.
So it was a warning from a 25-year-old John Mellencamp to you.
Yeah, and so it gave me some weird apprehension, you know? And then you pair it with the couplet, life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone.
That's crazy.
Dude, I mean, and that really affected me in a sort of a negative way. I liked the song and the video.
Understand.
But it affected me in a weird way. I'm like, oh, no.
That's a really nicely written rock line.
And it's almost like a gut punch to like, oh, crap, do we really, in a rock and roll song, do we need this reality?
Right, exactly.
There it was.
It's pretty jaded and hardcore for a young
almost
man.
Almost nihilistic, yeah.
Well, there you go.
Like, of course, the phrase sucking on the chili dog disturbed me in a different way. But we'll talk about that much later in the show.
We'll definitely be getting to that. But, you know, this song was so well written and so well delivered. And it seemed like he was kind of wise beyond his 25 years when he wrote this song. And he had had 4 records already under his belt before American Fool came out. Nothing really stuck. He has a kind of a joke line about this. He said that he had made 4 albums and had sold about 8 copies.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, probably bought.
Yeah, we probably did. We represented a great deal of that. But American Fool really stuck. Had a great album cover. The first release was Hurt So Good.
So Good. It was a huge hit.
That was a huge hit. And then this song came crackling across the radios. Very clean. Mm-hmm. Pretty simple. Really stood out at the time, would you say?
No, because it was so different. It was so different than anything else that was on the radio.
It didn't have like the big guitars and the hammer.
It was very spare, you know, very sparsely kind of populated. And you had, you know, like you had claps and you had, you know, like the, it was like, it sounded like there was just one guitar playing that main riff.
It's sort of a tiny, a tiny arrangement.
But lets the story kind of take center stage, and I think that was the whole point. And, you know,
agreed.
He, based on what I've read, he really was not convinced that they would ever get it done.
Oh, really?
You know, and that he believed in the song.
The record company did
not. They didn't believe in it at all.
Right.
But once they recorded it, he was like, okay, I think this is something. They, like, begged Barbara and Steele to get some video shot of him lip-syncing it.
Right.
And they pulled together that video, which looks like a bunch of home movies.
It certainly does. You know, which and a few snapshots.
I watched
mixed
today,
in.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just it was an interesting song that was probably not supposed to be a hit, but it was destined to be a hit. That makes sense.
No, I totally agree. You know, yeah, it was never devised as being like the big single, I wouldn't think. But apparently somebody at the record company must have believed in it enough to release it. Apparently there was some arm wrestling went on.
But they made him change it. You know,
true.
I'm sure you saw that. That originally, Jack and Diane were an interracial couple.
Right.
Jack was supposed to be an African-American.
A lot like Mellencamp, to always be pushing the envelope a little.
Right, and then he said that he had seen a lot of interracial couples at the time at his shows,
yeah.
And he wanted to reflect that part of America. And then the label was like, no, you need to focus more on your Midwestern audience.
Probably business-wise, they were right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he didn't really want to change it, but he did it.
He did it.
But he's always been really interested in integration of, especially, you know, blacks and whites. You know, that's something you can see in all his videos that he's put a lot of imagery out to that end, I believe.
Inclusiveness,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, he's a cool dude. A pretty good role model, I would say. But boy, did he was always butting heads, I think, with his band. With his record
company.
Well, he fired
tons of people.
Everybody he ever ran into.
Yeah. And, he, you know, like he had fired multiple people from his band. And he was sort of like the dude from Dexter's Midnight Runners, who was just such a perfectionist.
Exactly.
You know, it was just like, I'm sure he was hard to work with.
He was Kevin Rowland. Yeah.
Kevin Rowland.
He was
exactly,
much like that. Charlie Rose, I think, asked him, are you hard to deal with? And he said, I'm impossible to deal with.
There you go. And if he knows it and doesn't want to change it, you know, then that's, I mean, it's like, yeah, what are you going to do?
I think he feels
like, what
are
you going to do?
He's not willing to change it, and I think he feels like it's just so much part of him. It's part of his whole rebel kind of feel, and I think that, you know, he had the nickname Little Bastard along the way, which was also the name of James Dean's car that he crashed and sadly died in.
Yeah.
But Mellencamp's often compared to James Dean, and I think the record company saw him as sort of that kind of feel. This kid from rural Indiana that was very good looking, very cool, very rebellious, and they sold him sort of as that. But I don't feel like they were overselling that point because he really is that guy, you know?
Yeah.
But I want to go back in time just a bit. I want to ask you about some things, see if you knew this. Do you know he was born with a massive birth defect, spina bifida?
I've read that, but not today when I was doing research.
He had a lump on his neck, a third the size of his head, and he was not expected to live. And they had to talk with his mom about institutionalizing him or doing experimental surgery. So he was either going to basically spend his whole life in the hospital, maybe die as a baby. And his mom said, well, let's take a chance. You know, if it's either the hospital or experimental. And there were three babies in Riley's Children's that had the same condition. One died on the operating table. One lived life in a wheelchair and died at age 14. And that was a girl. And then John was a miracle.
Your rebel. Yeah.
Yeah, your rebel. Like somehow he had to be tough. He had to grow up, you know, maybe as an infant, right? You know?
Yeah.
But he never knew he had that.
He was smoking
condition.
By the time he was 2 years old.
Actually, 10.
10. I knew it was a young.
10 years old, he started smoking. Still smoking today.
Yeah. The miracle is still alive.
Another interesting fact about John's history is his mother was 1946 Miss Indiana runner up. Isn't that kind of cool?
Miss Seymour.
Oh, but she was certainly Miss Seymour, I would say. Yeah. Yeah, I was talking about him starting to smoke at age 10. He said he hadn't had a drink since college, though.
Oh, interesting.
He thinks the combination's bad, apparently.
Well, it definitely is, yeah.
He says smoking is the only thing he's good at, is what he says. So that's kind of one of his throw-off lines.
I did not see that. That's great. Yeah.
But when he was 18 or 17, he got his 20-year-old girlfriend pregnant, and they drove to Louisville and got married by the Justice of the Peace. They didn't have a witness, and a state policeman stood up with them, and... They didn't tell anybody. They went home and went back to their parents' houses, respectively. Like, he went to his and she went to hers. They didn't tell anybody. And a friend only found out because it was noted in the Courier Journal under the licenses granted, you know.
That's deal. Awesome.
So that's cool. Our hometown paper, or like
right here. Courier Journal.
Pretty neat.
I've actually written for them once or twice.
Oh, have you? Well, I'm sure. Let's see. There's some more interesting history that I always found really interesting was he had a early band called Trash. It was a cover band, and it was a glam band. He wore lipstick and like a half shirt type, you know. And,
I don't need to see that.
This and that type. No, you don't want to see that at all. But it was because David Bowie was big at the time. Right. But nothing was happening for him, so he goes to New York, and he talks to a man named Tony DeFries. And that's the guy that managed David Bowie and actually turned David Bowie from Davy Jones to David Bowie. So it's foreshadowing what's going to happen to John Mellencamp. Yeah. One of the things they did, Mellencamp says they didn't even listen to the demo. Didn't matter. They saw something in him, like a good-looking kid, maybe an ambitious, kind of tough little guy that they could sell, you know? So they went ahead and signed him to a record deal, and they... did the most, probably the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to the guy. They changed his name to John Cougar, and then they...
Johnny Cougar.
Johnny, yeah.
At first it was Johnny, yeah.
Correct, Johnny Cougar. He didn't find out till his album came out and it was on there. But then they, he says DeFries bought Seymour, and they changed Oktoberfest that year into Johnny Cougar Day. And they had a parade. And so everybody knows he's John Mellencamp.
Right.
This old punk that's been around here playing music in the bars. And now he's riding in a limo down the street in a convertible with Johnny Cougar on the side of the car. And everybody's celebrating him. Everybody came in from different parts of the country. A lot of people
from New York. There, Muhammad Ali.
He was.
You know, That's our local hero.
Yeah, that's the way it is. But then it was sort of manufactured in a way, you know, because
he didn't like it either. He didn't want to be Johnny Cougar.
He hated it.
Yeah.
He hated it. All right, so let's get back to the song itself. So what do you think about the construction of the song?
Well, the construction of the song, to me, again, we said it's sparse and it's different, and he sort of modeled it after the... What was the drum breakdown in the Phil Collins song?
Right. In the Air Tonight. Yes.
Yeah, In the Air Tonight. And like, so it sort of took a little, it took the wind out of that story in order to wind the story up and finish it. And that's what, to me, always kind of got me, is that it's a folk song, you know, and he said that, like, it always sounded great when I played it on my acoustic guitar, and then when we got in the studio, we could never get the band to do it right.
Really? Oh, I didn't hear that. Yeah.
And so when they got in there and started messing around with it, you know, Mick Ronson really was the one who arranged most of it and said, "Hey, here's
what you do." So that's David Bowie's guitar player.
Yeah.
Was involved, sure.
Yeah. And then, like, he was the one who said, like, the Let It Rock, Let It Roll. He's the one who said, we should put this in as a segue into the ending.
So sort of a really nice bridge. That's a really
beautiful
cool bridge.
Yeah. And then... they were like, it was like drum tracks.
Right. Kenny Aronoff is famously the drummer for
John
Mellencamp.
And they just said, we don't need you. We're doing electronic drums here.
Can you imagine what a day he was having?
Well, and the thing is, and he was wondering at the time, what's going to happen to real drummers? Because, the 80s were all about just programmed stuff. And,
absolutely.
And now we're back to that in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
But they got to that point where do we need something here, and Ronson said, let's do a drum breakdown, and they called him back into the studio
They summoned him.
And they said, just make up something on the spot. And he was like, I'm playing not only for my spot in this band, but for my career.
He was fighting for his life,
wasn't he? He was fighting for his professional life. And he came up with that awesome, I mean,
it's like, really nice.
And like, then it was like, oh, okay, now isn't he still his drummer?
He is not currently.
Oh, okay.
Because John went on such a hiatus for painting here a few years ago that he lost Larry Crane, his original guitar player, and Kenny Aronoff. I don't know what all behind the scenes happened, but John went on. John had his money. He was set up in life, and he took some real time off to become an all-day painter and didn't
so
really
painting barns and houses.
Oh yeah, pretty.
But he came down here to paint my my back porch.
He did paint the house as a promotion on MTV. Remember?
That's true. Paint the mother pank.
Yeah, that will live in infamy.
But so, just a little aside.
Yeah,
Kenny Aronoff follows me on Twitter. I have no idea why.
Well, here's what I'm going to say. That is a great thing. Kenny Aronoff is one of the finest men. I've actually talked to him
for about
a half hour. He is so kindly and gentle and nice. I went to a Henry Lee summer show at Theater Square in Louisville, and it was during a break from the Scarecrow tour. So to me, Kenny Aronoff was a big darn deal, and he had on a Scarecrow blue jean jacket. And he would have talked to me as long as I could have ever wanted to talk to him. Maybe 20, 30 minutes. We just chatted about Mellencamp and the tour and rock and roll, and it was delightful.
Who else played that show?
I cannot remember. I trust you and Harold's memories and maybe Mike Wetzel's on stuff like that.
Because I think that I might have been there.
Do you remember who else might have been there? I can maybe confirm.
It was Mark Maxwell, his band.
Oh, Shirley.
Okay. Whatever that band was called. I can't remember what they were called.
That's The Usual Suspects, I believe.
Yeah. Anyway.
Was it Spanky Lee?
It was.
Hey, there you go.
Spanky Lee? Yeah. Wow.
But one thing I want to say about the construction of this song is I think the...
Spanky Lee. Okay, you can edit that out if you want.
No,
we'll
keep all this. It's just color. But anyway, I look at these verses as little vignettes, you know, like it's a little sweet little story, The
visuals,
Last Picture Show.
Yes. You know, the Tasty Freeze. You know, everyone in this area knows about those little ice cream stands.
Absolutely.
And they always have chili dogs.
And it's such a Saturday night.
One, but I've eaten them many times. I didn't go get that phallic with it, you know, right, in my experiences. But the little things that he puts in there, like, you know, and, you know, Diane Debutante, backseat of Jackie's car, it's like, it's very, like, salacious.
Pretty suggestive, yes.
Yeah. But he doesn't go as far as saying they're having relations.
Well, like, you know, you got to think about a band like Bad Company's got on the radio about this time, I Feel Like Making Love and
stuff.
Mellencamp's a lot more artful about this stuff, but yet he's really painting like a true picture of the Midwestern, or, you know, probably you could put that in any city.
And so the point that all this makes me want to say is that this is the song that transformed him into what he wanted to be, which was a Midwestern storyteller.
Right.
And the fact that it was a number one for 4 weeks, it was so big, then he owned the record labels, and then he got to put Mellencamp in his name.
Yeah.
He said, this, now I've got the leverage.
He became a guy that could call his own shots.
Yep. And then we get Blood on the Scarecrow song, and we get all these other, you know, what was the song? I don't know his catalog as well as you do, but the old African-American couple in the video.
Oh, that is that's Pink Houses.
Pink Houses, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what helped him become that. So then he didn't have to do songs like Everyone Needs a Hand to Hold On To. You know, he went from like rocker to storyteller.
He really did. And boy, did he embrace it. There's a lot of John Steinbeck in his kind of feel. You know, I just think he's a poet.
Oh, interesting,
you know.
Yeah.
And with very few words, like say in Jack and Diane, with very few words, he paints this picture, and you can see everything that's going on.
Yep.
You can feel
that's the art of it.
It is art. But I kind of compare it to Don McLean, the American Pie song about the loss of innocence with the crash of Buddy Holly's plane. But like the verses are sort of picturesque, you know, they paint pictures, which I'm sure you know. What is that?
Behind the Shady Tree. There are just so many little things, little snippets that make you see it.
They make you see it. And then the chorus goes into these more broader strokes, you know, like...
Well, you got the Hold On to 16 as Long as You Can, broad.
Yeah.
You've got the, you know, what we just said before, the Life Goes On. You know,
oh yeah, yeah. Life goes on. All that.
So he blends those together to make it, you know, one big picture.
But they sort of stand. The choruses sort of stand aside from those verses, and they're, you know, life goes on long after the threat. They're a little more philosophical. You know, reminds me of sort of like My Miss American Pie, that stuff, you know, drove the Chevy to the levee stuff. He gets a little bit of that sort of thing in there. But holding on to 16 as long as you can, and changes coming around.
One of the great lines in rock.
So good.
Because rock and roll traditionally was made for teenagers.
Well, there you go.
And we were 16.
Yes, we were.
So that's why it hit me so hard, as I said before.
It just blew my mind. I remember exactly where I was when I heard this song, as I do with some of the more formative songs of my life. I was at the corner of Small House Road and Scottsville Road in Bowling Green, Kentucky with my buddy. I spent my summers a lot of times, or quite a bit of my summer, in Bowling Green at the time. And I remember that song came on and I was digging it. And my buddy Dave said, "That guy's from Indiana." And I'm like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, John Cougar, he's from Indiana." And somehow Hurt So Good hadn't got on my radar so much as being, you know, this guy, John Cougar from Indiana. But at that moment, I thought, I want to know more about this guy.
Well, it's a more memorable song for sure.
I think it is. I think it is.
So this quote from Song Facts, which I print out because I love it, or you print it up.
Yeah.
So he said, the image that was given to me by the record company was so far off base of who I was and what I wanted to do. I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I knew what I didn't want to do. I did not want to be Johnny Cougar. I did not want to sing love songs. I did not want to be the next Neil Diamond, which is what they wanted.
He said he wrote a love song one time, and then he burned his clothes after. He didn't want to write love songs.
Well, of course he did. That's awesome.
Oh, I thought that was hilarious. A girl gave him some advice one time. He doesn't name who it was, but she said, "You're a pair of blue jeans."
Yeah, just be a pair of blue jeans.
Just be a pair of blue jeans, she said. Yeah. And she said, "The thing about blue jeans is you can dress them up or you can dress them down."
Yeah.
I feel like it kind of does capture his kind of feel, doesn't it?
For sure. One of the things I've noted was that it is the song structure.
Yeah.
The clapping was supposed to be taken out.
Really?
It was just there for rhythm and timing.
Whoa.
And then when they took it out in the final mixing, they were like, "No, that has to stay."
Well,
and
that's
one of the most memorable things about the song is the clapping.
Oh, I love it.
When they put the white gloved hands in the video.
Yeah, that was a production assistant.
Yeah.
He said he charged nothing to do the claps.
Yep.
But they're kind of, that's an odd video, would you say? It looks probably
with all the windows popping up, and
it looks 15 years older than it is. Maybe I don't know.
It looks like home movies.
Yeah, it like very much movies, looks like home movies,
because it's like you got the pictures. Some of them are of him, and I don't know. It's so odd.
The parts of him singing were shot at a bar in Medora, Indiana, and then the scenes of him and his wife at the time were filmed at their home in Bloomington, like just around their
neighborhood,
their lands or whatever. So, but a few shots of John on the motorcycle, which never hurts your kind of image, you know. But this album, American Fool, with Hurt So Good, Jack and Diane, there's a lot of really good songs on that album, prompted me to ask for my first guitar from my parents for Christmas, and they bought me a perfect little acoustic Alvarez cheapy pawn shop guitar. And when you hear Queen or Led Zeppelin, you don't think, "Wow, I want to get a guitar. I think I could do that." When you hear Mellencamp, you think, "I want to play music. I think I could do that," you know?
Yeah.
And his songs are pretty easy. You know, they're very three chord type songs. Yeah. And so I set countless hours, you know, when I was still living at my parents' house, still at home, strumming these songs. That's how I learned how to play guitar, was through playing Mellencamp songs. And it was just a great time for me and something I really cherish to this day. I can just picture those nights, you know.
And that's why you're closer to it than I am.
Yeah, probably so.
For me, it was more social, because I had to listen to a lot of country music
up
until that point with my, because I hung out with my dad and my grandpa a lot. And they all listened to like old school country.
Oh, so yeah, that's pretty cool.
It wasn't that far of a jump from country to Mellencamp.
He had a little bit of that flavor, didn't he?
Yeah, because it was Americana.
Sure.
You know? So absolutely. It was easy for me to go ahead and say, okay, cool. Let's, you know, I can dig with this and I can get with this. Let's talk about, is there another musical couple bigger than Jack and Diane?
I think that's a great question.
Is there another musical couple that even exists or compares?
So when I was studying this on the internet, I got almost nothing. Like, they say most of them are like robbed from literature or film, like Jack and Jill or Romeo and Juliet.
Right. Yep.
Bonnie and Clyde type thing.
So, I thought of the duet Love is Strange, and I can't remember the name of the duo that sang it, but that is about a couple in a relationship.
Oh, okay.
But they're not named.
Right.
They're just called Lover Boy, you know. And
right.
So Jack and Diane is like the quintessential rock and roll musical couple.
Mellencamp himself has declared to be the most famous couple in rock and roll.
So. And is like, and he's like sometimes like sick of them. And he refers to them as people.
Does he?
Did you see that?
I think I did see something.
I got a great quote from him.
He said he can't get too awfully tired of them because they've sold so well.
Here we go. Here's the quote. As much as I'm a little weary of these two, I don't know any other two people in rock and roll who are more popular than Jack and Diane. Some people probably think there's a place in hell for me because of those two people.
Ooh.
But it gave me the keys to do what I want. I'm 57 today. This is a while back. Yeah. I've lived the way I wanted to live, sometimes recklessly and stupidly, but I've still been able to do that. I've been able to live on my whims, and that's what Jack and Diane gave me, so I can't hate them too much. So there, he treats them like they're people.
Well,
which is really interesting to me as a creator myself.
He gave life to them, sure.
I mean, when I was writing my first book, I literally, the main character was named Michael Lamb, and I thought of Michael as being a real person because he was with me all the time, sort of like Dale on our old radio show.
Inhabits a part of your brain.
Inhabits part of your brain, and it's like they're a real person.
Yeah.
You know, and you're thinking, what would this person do in this situation? What would they think about this? And so he's obviously got Jack and Diane in his head, for better or worse.
I guess in a way,
if you're a creator, you understand that, I think.
Totally. I mean, it's amazing that how long he's lived with them now, you know. But to me, now, thinking back on the Jack and Jill and Romeo and Juliet, I think Jack and Diane are sort of, at the time, the modern version of Romeo and Juliet. They didn't have a sad story like that, or Jack and Jill, these two people you put together, this couple that will forever live, their names linked. Did you know Weird Al wanted to do a parody?
Yes.
Did you see that?
Yes, about the royal couple.
It was called Charles and Diane, right?
Yeah.
Chuck and Diane. And John wouldn't give him permission.
Yep. And out of respect, he decided not to do it, and so he just used the lyrics for something else.
Don't you think it's interesting that Weird Al asked for permission to do these things, and if somebody doesn't give it to him, he doesn't do it?
He doesn't do it.
What do you think of Mellencamp's decision on first glance, I think, oh man, I love Weird Al and I love those parodies. But do you feel like it might be a good decision of John not to let that song get sort of co-opted?
Maybe. Yeah, I can see it. Although I don't think that the Weird Al version has hurt other songs, even like Eat It.
Right.
I think even Eat It hasn't, as big as it was.
They sort of live separately.
Yeah.
Maybe that's true.
Now, that said, there's something else we have to talk about.
Uh-oh.
and that is the more recent parody of the song by our friend.
Oh, yes.
Clownish Presley. Yeah. Before we get to that, though.
Yeah.
You've met John. You've talked to John, haven't you?
I have. Briefly spoke to John. I got to express my love for John once.
Right.
Yes. I was at IU versus Minnesota football game somewhere around 1992 when he had just recently married, I guess, his supermodel.
The supermodel, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know her name?
I can't remember her name.
Anyway, I don't want to guess a name because I probably wouldn't get it right. But anyway, they were standing by the press elevator waiting to go up to sort of the press box area so they wouldn't be harassed, right? So I've been lying with my wife and my buddy Joey, and I was you know, pretty darn young at the time and totally obsessed with John Mellencamp's music. And we saw him standing there with kind of shades on, standing with his, and she stood out more than him in a way, because she's like, you know,
she was like 6 inches
statuesque
tall.
And yeah, beautiful. Yeah. But anyway, so I saw him there and I'm having this debate with myself. This is my chance to say hi to John Mellencamp. And so I just like, I thought, I got to go. So I darted out of line waiting to get into the game and went over there and I said, John, I hate to bother you, but I'm a huge fan and I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't try to, you know, at least get your autograph or something, which nowadays I probably wouldn't try to get the autograph. Yeah. I would probably just say, man, I love your music and I just want to shake your hand. Yeah. Yeah, that would be more like it now. But anyway, he said not a word, smiled, took my ticket and a pen. I had a pen. I got one from Jane. And then he put the ticket on his leg, signed it, and was very pleasant and smiling. You know, this guy, he can be a little kind of tough. But anyway, smiles and handed it to me. Didn't start a conversation, but I said, thank you, and I ran back to line. But my thought was he didn't want to start a conversation because he didn't want it to sort of develop into more people being there. Then he can't go watch the game, right?
Well, my only a few personal experiences with John was when I covered IU basketball.
Yeah.
He was always at the home games, and he sat in the student section in the end zone, and I was always on the press row.
So you had decisions to make too.
Well, but again, I wasn't you. So there was more than one time when I walked out, and he was like right next to me, shoulder to shoulder.
Not exactly shoulder to shoulder.
No, because he was more like up to my elbow.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's a really small man.
He is.
But I never said a word to him. I thought, you know what? No one else is saying a word to him. They're used to all the students. Everyone's used to him being here.
So they respected his ability to come to a game and just kind of do his thing.
And so I'm like, why am I going to be, you know? And so I just would look over at him and be like, that's John Mellencamp.
Major rock star.
And he's just walking around doing his thing because he's a huge IU fan. And then the other memory I have, I was my buddy Rob, who's going to be a guest on this show at some point.
Yeah.
He's a big Beatles guy.
Super musician.
Great musician. And we were coming back from Bloomington. We had moved his then girlfriend back from college.
Uh-huh.
And we were driving down the state road, and we were just talking, and there was this big red SUV coming toward us, and it was the supermodel wife and John in the front seat, and she was driving.
Ah!
She was driving, and they passed it. We both stopped talking, and we looked. He was like, "That was John Mellencamp." I was like, "It was John Mellencamp."
It's kind of thing that can happen around here.
So that's what it's like being in Indiana. He's just there, you know.
Well, part of what he did to inspire me was you know, you're used to rock stars being from London, New York,
not Seymour,
or L.A. You know, they weren't necessarily from those places, but that's where they made their bones. That's where they got famous out of, you know. Yeah. And with maybe Bob Seger as an exception, you know, usually you're used to these kind of the coast producing the fare of the day. And so it was neat to have a guy from less than an hour away from where we lived that went to the top of the mountain.
56.4 miles.
But anyway,
no, 54.6, sorry.
But with light traffic, that's an hour. I'm gonna say
it's an hour.
But anyway, it just was amazing to me that a guy from Indiana could go that big. I mean, of course, Michael Jackson from Indiana, but you don't think of it that way, really. So all right, before we get to Clownvis, which I think is a very important part of the show, I want to read something my buddy Chris Robinson posted on my Facebook couple years ago, I think it is now, or maybe a year ago.
Right.
He kind of has a way with words, and this is pretty sentimental and everything, and I'll try to get through it without being emotional.
Okay.
But anyway, this is what he left on my timeline.
I'm going to tease you. You know that.
Well, that's fine. That's part of the, yeah. But this really relates to tonight's topic, obviously. So, there's nothing like childhood friends. This was written right after we got together with our high school buddies. It was sort of an impromptu reunion with our closest buddy. So there's nothing like childhood friends, those buddies you grew up with, shared high school days with, the girlfriends, the fights, the laughter, the music. Those were our days. That was our time. You really don't understand how special those days are until you have family of your own, until you have children and even grandchildren that are walking the path that you walked so many moons ago. John Mellencamp, who wrote the soundtrack for our lives,
said, hold on to 16 as long as you can, for changes are coming that will make us women and men. And just like those 16-year-old wide-eyed boys that are now in their 50s, hair has been displaced. That hurts a little bit. Pounds. Oh, you know, that's good. Pounds have been found. That hurts a little bit as well.
That's me, yeah.
But our love of life and of each other remains the same. Tomorrow never comes. Today never stays. And yesterday is forever gone. But friendships last forever. So that's Chris Robinson, my good buddy.
Wow.
I thought he put it together pretty good.
He did.
A lot of the sentiments from that song and how it relates to our lives.
And what kind of what made John what he was as a songwriter. Man. Once he was able to kind of dictate that.
So good. And so now on a lighter side.
On the lighter side.
Explain how we ran across this guy.
What was it, like 4 years ago?
Perhaps.
We went to see the Blasters in Lexington, Kentucky.
Yep.
The Blasters, yep. A great rockabilly band from back in the 80s.
Amazing band.
That our friend Harold and I discovered back then. And we went to see them, and there was it you or Harold who said, there's some act called Clownless Pressy opening for them.
Which must have been Harold, yeah.
It was Harold, and we were like, what's that even mean? And so he came out on stage in his makeup with a big Elvis wig and an Elvis, you know, like 70s jumpsuit.
And clown makeup.
And just wowed us.
And blew our minds,
blew our minds.
Yeah.
And the crowning part of the show was he said, I'm going to play that, you know, that Sucking on a Chili Dog song. He's like, I don't know all the words to it. But he played it on his boombox and sang along.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, Sucking on a Chili Dog, Sucking on a Chili Dog. And he was interspersing John's lyric with, he just changed everything to, you know, Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, sucking on a chili dog.
Did he have any other words? I thought
he did.
All.
No. When we saw him, he didn't. But I went and looked at a video today, and he was interspersing.
So he followed the melody and put a lot of sucking on the chili dog in the song.
Well, and I watched a video today, and he said it's the moment in his show when he wins over his audience.
Yes.
When the laughter turns to tears, and people say, I like this guy. And that's the experience I had. I had my picture taken with him afterward. I was so excited. I bought a shirt. Then, a year or so ago, some guy named Tom McGovern, who is a TikTok star.
I saw his name mentioned, yeah.
Did his own version of it. Huh? It's all just sucking on a chili dog. He just did all of it.
Oh, he didn't. Oh, okay, yeah.
And so, it's got that video on TikTok has like 30,000 shares. So upon thousands of views.
So would you say he ripped off Clownvis Presley, who ripped off Mellencamp, or?
Well, here's the thing.
All right.
Tom had never, ever heard of Clownvis's version or of him. It was one of those separate things where they both had the same joke in mind.
They independently.
Yeah. Independently had the idea.
Wow.
And so when Clownvis, when he heard about this, his fans were like, you've got to sue this guy. You've got to stop him. You've got to.
Right.
And you know Clownvis's move was?
What?
Invite him on his show.
Oh.
He said, come be on my podcast.
Wow.
And so, and they talked it out. And he, and like.
As men?
As men. And so I've linked both versions in the show notes, folks. And I've also linked this interview.
Cool.
You want to go watch it. It's fun. But anyway, you go watch it because he...
It's amazing.
Like,
yeah.
Clownvis is like, all right, Tom, I've got to ask you a very important question. I need you to be really, really, really honest. And he goes through this whole... And you're like, oh, God, he's going to ask, did you rip me off on purpose?
Right.
You know? And finally, when he asks the question, he's like, have you ever really sucked on a chili dog?
That's what it came
down to.
And
that's how he set it up. So, yeah, watch the video. It's really funny.
Dude.
And it's really copacetic because, you know, I think he reached out and he said, Tom, obviously... We thought of this independently.
Right.
So just let's have fun with it. Come on the show. We can support each other.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it's a really like a really kind of a nice, it's a 10-minute video, 10-minute interview, you know.
But I think our encounter with Clownvis kind of changed our lives in a small way.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. I still wear the shirts. I've worn the shirt on stage when we played.
Well, good.
Yeah.
So do you have anything else, any other recollections on your life with Mellencamp? I mean.
The only other one was a personal experience that I had that ties me to the song forever.
Sure.
I was 16, and I was holding on to it as long as I could.
Yeah, good.
And I was working at Ponderosa Steakhouse in Clarksville, Indiana.
Yep.
About 52.4 miles from from Seymour.
Just a little closer.
And,
yeah.
And my coworker, Diane Goffinette, was really into the song.
Good.
She sang it all the time. She was really super cute, a couple years older than me, so I had a crush, but of course I knew there was no chance. And she walked in. I was washing dishes, and she walked in and stopped in front of me, and she just said, "Little ditty by Jack and Diane, two American kids living in the heartland." And I said, "Where's the heartland?" She said, "I have no idea." And she just walked out of the kitchen. And I don't know why I remember that exchange.
It's great.
I thought it was so odd and so weird that I just was, I've never forgotten that. I can still see her face. She said, "I have no idea."
But little did you know, you were in it.
I was in it. I was, yeah, I was living the, you know, the good old days before I knew they were the good old days. So well, that's my last take on Jack and Diane. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this.
Absolutely.
We have enjoyed it.
And if Mr. John Cougar ever gets to hear this, I just would love to thank him for all the music. It's been...
I think his name's Mellencamp.
Yeah. Mr. What, did I say John Cougar?
You did.
If Mr. John Mellencamp is listening to this
podcast, he's already tuned out now.
I'm sure he has. I'm sure we offended him along the way. But anyway, I think he's enriched our lives. I mean, especially mine. And he brought me into music and it made me want to learn the cowboy chords and get going, you know, and here we are today playing music.
He made me want to make out with Diane.
Well, there you go. Plenty good. And we learned a new word today, dragon floister.
Dragon floister. Dragon Look floister. It up. It doesn't exist.
All right. Good night, buddy.
Good and, night, buddy. Another good one. Good let's come back soon. Thanks, everybody. Sucking on a chili dog. Sucking on a chili dog.
What are they known for over there?
Fish and chips.
Fish and chips.